So the next chapter is called Unsupported and Unsupportive Consciousness. So again, appreciating that English is not the first language of everybody here, by any means. So unsupported means consciousness that is not landing upon anything, is not settling upon anything. And unsupportive is consciousness that is not holding anything up. So there's different teachings, different imagery that the Buddha uses, speaking about consciousness as a transcendent or liberated quality. So we brought these two different modes, unsupported and unsupportive, so that the meaning of the title of the chapter. So we start off with the unsupported. Also, it just coincidentally connects with the quotation I was finishing things with yesterday from John Cage. If you let it, it supports itself. You don't have to. Each something is a celebration of the nothing which supports it. If you remove the world from your shoulders, you discover it doesn't drop. Where is the responsibility? So that is, in a related vein, I would say, that the Dhamma is unsupported. You know, it's like when you remove the world from your shoulders, it doesn't drop. Interestingly, the root of the word Dhamma, dhr in Sanskrit, or that's my bad pronunciation, literally means to uphold, to support, to integrate, that which holds together. The DHR is the root of Dhamma. So, to begin this chapter. One of the ways in which the Buddha characterized the quality of awareness was to present it as a form of consciousness, vijnana. This represents a unique usage of the term. Customarily, vijnana only refers to the conditioned activity of the six senses. However, we also find that the Buddha gives us some adjectives with which to describe it when the term is used in this unique way, as a referring to a transcendent quality. And then we have the Pali sentence, vijnanang anidasanang anantang sabato pabhang. Consciousness that is signless, boundless, all luminous, is one translation of this expression. And this is one of Lumpur Sumedho's favorite Pali sentences, to the extent that we put that on the giveaway mug for his 90th birthday celebrations. When we asked him, what should we put on your LPS 90 mug, then it was that phrase. So the English translation of that phrase was what he suggested. It almost goes without saying that there is controversy as to the precise meaning of this enigmatic phrase. It appears in only a couple of places in the canon, in Sutta number 49, in the Majjhima, the middle-length discourses, and Sutta number 11, in the long discourses. However, the constellation of meanings of the individual words is small enough to give us a reasonably clear idea of what the Buddha was pointing at. Firstly, we must assume that he is using vijnana, quote-unquote, in a broader way than it usually is meant. The Buddha avoided the nitpicking pedantry of many philosophers contemporary with him and opted for a more broad-brush, colloquial style geared to particular listeners in a language which they could understand. And that was something talked about in the first chapter, about how the Buddha used language in a very accessible and broad imaginative way according to the groups of people that he was talking to and the particular situation that was occurring. Thus, vijnana here can be assumed to mean knowing, quote-unquote, but not the partial, fragmented, discriminative knowing, and that's the usual etymology of vijnana, vi meaning partial, fragmented, discriminative, and then jnana as in knowing, so vijnana, the discriminative consciousness or separative consciousness, which the word usually implies. Instead, it must mean a knowing of a primordial, transcendent nature. Otherwise, the passage which contains it would be self-contradictory. So that in the flow of what the Buddha is saying, his usage of the word vijnana has to be referring to some kind of liberated, transcendent quality of knowing or awareness. Otherwise, the passages don't make sense. Secondly, anidasanang is a fairly straightforward word which means meaning not, or no, without. Nidasanang, which means indicative, visible, or manifestative. So that's something which appears and manifested and is apparent. So anidasana is invisible, empty, featureless, unmanifest. Or in Bhikkhu Nyanananda's term, non-manifestative, which is a very, very long English word. You wouldn't find it in most English conversations, but it's pretty accurate, and that's what Bhikkhu Nyanananda uses, non-manifestative. Anantang is also a straightforward term, meaning infinite or limitless. The final phrase, sabato pabhang, is a little trickier. Here is Bhikkhu Bodhi's comment from note 513 to the Majjhima Nikaya. The Majjhima commentary, the ancient commentary, offers three explanations of the phrase sabato pabhang. One, completely possessed of splendor, pabha. Two, possessing being, pabhutang, everywhere. So possessing being everywhere. And three, a ford, that's like a shallow part of a river that you can walk through, which is pabhang, accessible from all sides, i.e. through any of the 38 meditation objects. And Bhikkhu Bodhi's comment on those three is only the first of these seems to have any linguistic legitimacy. So that quality of radiance or splendor, pabha, which means light or radiance. It's perhaps also significant that both of these instances where this phrase is used by the Buddha are in passages involving the demonstration of his superiority over the Brahma gods. It's thus conceivable that the phraseology derives from some spiritual or mythological principle dear to the Brahmins and which the Buddha is employing to expand the familiar meaning or to turn it around, as we saw in chapter 2 earlier on. This was a common source of the Buddha's choice of words and metaphorical images. And I'm grateful to Lumpo Pasana when we were developing this book. It was his comments around that saying, you know, it's interesting and I think it's significant that that particular sentence or that kind of phrasing is only used when the Buddha is either speaking about this incident in the invitation to the Brahma Sutta, Sutta 49 from the Majjhima, or the Kevada Sutta. There's Brahma gods involved in both of those, and so Lumpo Pasana said, I think somehow that's connected with Brahminical teachings, because that's the only place you find that phraseology. If you remember bringing that up, I thought it was very insightful.
Very vague.
I've quoted you many, many times since then. But it's very similar, I would say. I was giving the example a while ago with the Bahia Sutta, when the Buddha says, in the seen there is only the seen, in the heard there is only the heard. So the languaging of that exchange of the Buddha with Bahia is, again, quite unique. People have wondered, that's a strange phraseology that the Buddha is using. But it seems it's closely connected to one of the Upanishads, one of the Hindu scriptures or Vedic scriptures, that was particularly important to the ascetics who had the tradition of wearing robes made out of tree bark, so bark-clad ascetics. And Bahia seems to have been one of those bark-wearing ascetics. And so the Buddha seeing, oh, this wanderer, this sannyasin, he's from this group, this will be a familiar teaching to him. And so taking a phrase or a symbolism from a particular practice and then putting his own twist on it. So that's a very, very common mode of the Buddha. I've never managed to find a source. I've mentioned this many times and asked a few Sanskrit scholars if they can come up with anything, but we never discovered it. But I feel that's extremely likely that the word vijnana, or the vijnana with the J in the Sanskrit, is probably used in that way in a scripture, maybe one that's been lost or not been translated or is a bit obscure, because that would match the Buddha's style and his mode of expression in other situations. So just to briefly share that, it's not identical to that Vijnanang Anidasanang Anantang Sabato Pabhang, but it's closely related. So this is in the Sutta 49, the invitation of a Brahma. So the translation of that same kind of or related phrase here is, the consciousness that makes no showing, nor has to do with finiteness, not claiming being with respect to all. And that's the similar phrase that you have in this sutta. And then, again, it's related to those teachings I was talking about, eternalism, where the Buddha is saying not commensurate with the earthiness of earth, with the wateriness of water, or the allness of the all. Talking about that quality of consciousness, in this respect, that is not identified with or limited by or entangled with any kind of object, including the sabba, the all. The next verse that the Buddha pronounces, the Brahma's trying to display his superiority over the Buddha, he says, well, you might be able to say that, but I will vanish from you and you won't be able to see where I've gone. And then the Brahma Bhaka tries to disappear and he can't vanish from the Buddha's view. And then the Buddha says, not to be showing off, but just to demonstrate that my understanding, my state of realization is superior to yours. I'll vanish from you and you won't be able to see me. And then Brahma thinks, I can't possibly do that. Thereupon I said, Brahma, I shall vanish from you. Vanish from me if you can, good sir. Then I performed such a feat of supernormal power that the Brahma and the Brahma's assembly and the members of the Brahma's assembly could hear my voice, but could not see me. After I had vanished, I uttered the stanza. Having seen fear in every mode of being, and in being seeking for non-being, I did not affirm any mode of being, nor did I cling to any delight in being. So again, it's a very rich and illuminating sutta on its own. Before going on to the Kevada Sutta, any questions, thoughts, clarifications useful? Any comments from Paul? You haven't discovered that verses from the Vedas in all these years?
No.
It could easily be one of those memorized texts that has been sort of lost over the centuries. So.
Yes, and you know, some of the nuances of the how the Buddha related to the culture of the time and the pundits of the time, or you know, much of that is not, it's probably been lost.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
His saying that Buddha made himself invisible, as sutras always to be taken literally.
Yes. The words of the sutta saying that he did that. And there's other instances where he, early on in his teaching career, he did that kind of thing a few times. But it seems after a few years, he realized that when he, and not just turning invisible or that kind of thing, he noticed or realized that if he performed those kind of psychic feats, then everyone focused on the fact that he and the Sangha were flying through the air or they could disappear and become invisible or such like, and they would ignore the teachings because they're so kind of giddy over the marvelous psychic performance. And so it seems that after a few years, it's difficult to say how long, but it seems like 2 or 3 years maybe, a few years after the Buddha's enlightenment, only in cases of emergency, he made a public demonstration of that kind of thing. But early on, there's quite a few things like that. For example, when Yasa, who was a young man who'd had a kind of rude awakening in a party and had been sort of disgusted by all of his friends and companions sort of lying around half drunk, snoring and dribbling and drooling, leaves the party and goes off and then comes across the Buddha meditating out in the park and then sits down, receives a teaching and becomes a stream enterer. Seemingly, well, he hasn't completely got over the effects of the party, which is an interesting item. And then his dad comes along looking for him. And then the Buddha conceals Yasa, makes Yasa invisible. And so he has a conversation with the dad until the father becomes a stream enterer, and then he lets Yasa be made visible again. According to the stories, it was the sort of thing that a fully enlightened Buddha can quite comfortably do. Maybe so. I don't find it difficult to give credence to that kind of thing. And, you know, being up in a Brahma world, on that score, that in itself is pretty remarkable, going up to the high heavenly realms and having conversations with beings up there. That in itself is a pretty remarkable scenario. And it's interesting that the reason why he went to visit was because he realized through his meditation that this Brahma god Bhaka had formed a conceited view, thought he was the creator of the universe, the most supreme being and creator of all beings and the most powerful deity. And Bhaka had been a teacher of the Buddha in a previous lifetime. And so it was this sense that, oh, my former teacher is now deluded. He's in this Brahma world, but he's in this deluded state. I wonder if I can go and help him to be free from that delusion. So it was an act of compassion to go and help his former teacher be freed from a conceited view. That was the motivation for him to go up to that Brahma world. Also, in Indian folklore, Bhaka means heron, and in Indian folklore, the heron is always a kind of proud, sort of snooty, got that image in Indian folktales. So it's a kind of, having a Brahma god called heron is a sort of jibe at the Brahmins. seemingly. Venerable Ananda Maitreya pointed that out, that it's echoing that sort of vain and conceited quality that was there, just happens to have the name Heron. Anyway, to continue. The longer of the two versions of this phrase comes at the end of a colourful and lengthy teaching tale recounted by the Buddha in the Kevadda Sutta, which is Sutta number 11 in the Digha Nikaya, Long Discourses. He tells of a monk in the mind of whom the question arises, I wonder where it is that the four great elements, earth, water, fire and wind, cease without remainder. And the Buddha's telling this story to Kevadda, who's come to see the Buddha. Being a skilled meditator, the bhikkhu in question enters a state of absorption and, quote, the path to the gods becomes open to him, unquote. He begins by putting his question to the first gods he meets, the retinue of the four heavenly kings, the guardians of the world, the Lokapala. They demur, which means that they say, oh, we don't know, I'm sorry, can't help you, saying that they do not know the answer, but that the four kings themselves probably do. He should ask them. So this bhikkhu asks the four great kings, they don't know either, and the search continues. Onward and upward through successive heavens he travels, continually being met with the same reply, oh, we don't know, but you should try asking upstairs, indicating the next heavenly level above, and is referred to the next higher level of the celestial hierarchy. In the Dhammacakka Sutta that we chant, we have the Bhuma Devas, the earth spirits, and then Chatu Maharajikas, the four great kings, then the Tavatinksa, the heaven of the 33, then the Yama Devas, Tusita Devas, the Paranimittavasa, the Nimanarati Devas, those who delight in creating, and then those who delight in the creations of others, and then the Brahma worlds begin the next one up. So it goes all the way through those seven sensual heavens up into the Brahma world. Patiently enduring the protracted process of following this cosmic chain of command, he finally arrives in the presence of the retinue of Mahabrahma. He puts the question to them. These are the courtiers of Mahabrahma, Mahabrahma's Brahma attendants. Puts the question to them. Once again, they fail to produce an answer, but they assure him that the great Brahma himself, should he deign to manifest, is certain to provide him with the resolution he seeks. Sure enough, before too long, he, capital H, appears, and at this point we are treated to a taste of the wry wit of the Buddha. So this is in a quotation from the Kevadda Sutta, and this is Maurice Walsh's translation of the Digha Nikaya. And that monk went up to him and said, Friend, where do the four great elements, earth, water, fire, air, cease without remainder? To which the great Brahma replied, Monk, I am Brahma. Great Brahma, the conqueror, the unconquered, the all-seeing, all-powerful, the Lord, the maker and creator, the ruler, appointer and orderer, father of all that have been and shall be. Second time the monk said, Friend, I didn't ask you if you are Brahma, great Brahma, and so on. I asked you where the four great elements cease without remainder. The second time the great Brahma replied as before. And a third time the monk said, Friend, I did not ask you that. I asked where the four great elements, earth, water, fire, air, cease without remainder. Then, Kevadda, the great Brahma took that monk by the arm, led him aside, and said, Monk, these devas believe there is nothing Brahma does not see. There is nothing he doesn't know. There is nothing he is unaware of. That's why I did not speak in front of them. But, monk, I don't know where the four great elements cease without remainder. And therefore, monk, you have acted wrongly. You have acted incorrectly by going beyond the blessed Lord and going in search of an answer to this question elsewhere. Now, monk, you just go to the blessed Lord and put this question to him, and whatever answer he gives, accept it. So, kind of casually mentions that the monk was actually living in the same monastery as the Buddha when he carried out this search. So the Mahabrahma is saying, I don't know, but, you know, why are you asking me? You should ask the Buddha. He's the great master, the blessed Lord. He's the one who really knows. You should ask him. So, that monk, as swiftly as a strong man might flex or unflex his arm, vanished from the Brahma world and appeared in my presence. He prostrated himself before me, then sat down to one side and said, Lord, where do the four great elements, the earth element, the water element, the fire element, and the air element, cease without remainder? I replied, But, monk, you should not ask your question in this way. Where do the four great elements, earth element, water element, the fire element, the air element, cease without remainder? Instead, this is how the question should have been put. Where do earth, water, fire and air no footing find? Where can they find a landing place? Where are long and short, small and great, fair and foul? Where are name and form wholly destroyed? And the answer is, where consciousness is signless, boundless, all luminous. That's where earth, water, fire and air find no footing. There both long and short, small and great, fair and foul, their name and form are wholly destroyed. With the cessation of consciousness, this is all destroyed. Thus the Lord spoke, and the householder Kevanda delighted, rejoiced at his words. An alternative translation renders the final verses thus, and this is from Bhikkhu Nyanananda. Where do earth and water, fire and wind, long and short, fine and coarse, pleasant and unpleasant, no footing find? Where is it that name and form are held in check, with no trace left? And then the answer is, consciousness, which is non-manifestative, endless, lustrous on all sides. Here it is that earth and water, fire and wind, no footing find. Here again are long and short, subtle and gross, pleasant and unpleasant, name and form, all cut off without exceptions. When consciousness comes to cease, these are all held in check herein. Those last words in Pali, name and form are all cut off without exceptions, namancha rupancha asesang uparujati, and then the last one, when consciousness comes to cease, they're all held in check herein, vinyanasa nirodhena ethetang uparujati. As mentioned earlier, there's been considerable debate over the centuries as to the real and precise meaning of these verses. Rather than try to put forth the definitive meaning that will settle the question forever, perhaps it's wiser just to consider the elements of the teaching that are presented here and let one's own understanding arise from that contemplation. Before going into the semantics of it and looking at the individual words and translations, even though this is sort of talking about visiting a Brahma world, this can seem quite abstruse, I would say this is very, very close to what we're doing in the work of insight meditation, Vipassana meditation, establishing that quality of awareness that is knowing the field of experience, hearing, seeing, smelling, tasting, touching, thought, memory, imagination, different states of consciousness, concentration, and so on, arising and passing away, and then not giving them a landing place, not providing a footing. So when you say they find no footing, finding a footing is saying, I like that sound, I don't like that sound, or ouch, that hurts, or oh, this is good. That's giving those sense objects a footing, a landing place. And then this state, this quality, vinyanang anidasanang anantang sabbatopabang, that vinyanang anidasanang, the non-manifestative consciousness, it's not giving substantiality, it's not giving a landing place to sense objects, to making them more real and substantial than they are. Long and short, coarse and fine, pure and impure, it's recognizing that all of those are subjective judgments, that they are qualities that the habits of the mind are imputing, they're giving to those patterns of experience. And so that quality of anidasana vijnana, as Lumpur Sumedho often uses that as a shorthand, it's that quality of awareness that is not giving strength to those dualities, long and short, coarse and fine, here and there, subject and object, inside, outside, pure, impure, and so forth. So that's, I would say, a simple or a more tangible way of understanding it. It might sound a bit remote or kind of strange or foreign or a bit too subtle, but really it's exactly what we're doing, watching our minds, that giving no landing place, not giving a place for those dualities and those substantialities to land. That's the essence of it. Yes?
You struck me before about that passage you read out. Because on the one hand, it's referring to a consciousness that is infinite and radiant and non-manifestative.
Non-manifestative.
But then it goes on to say when consciousness is cessation, so it's almost referring to the same two things as being, you know, water, fire, and everything.
So it's something that occurred to me before. I don't know if you've got any.
In a way, it's using vijnana in a couple of different ways. It's reverting to the other more common usage of vijnana, that cessation of consciousness. It's a cessation of discriminative consciousness. I feel it's a sort of a mixture of the Buddha using vijnana as that sort of transcendent, liberated quality of awareness, and then the much more familiar, partial, fragmented, discriminative knowing. Very good question, well spotted. One of those, how does that work? I'll go into some of the etymologies and the different translations for these words in this next section here. As mentioned earlier, there's been considerable debate over the centuries as to the real and precise meaning of these verses, etc. Having said that, there are two semantic points which are important to understand in order to appreciate these verses better. Firstly, name and form. These are nama rupa in the Pali. They are two very common terms, and along with the way they've been translated here, they were used by the Buddha equally to refer to mentality and materiality respectively. So name is also nama as in mental or mentality, and the rupa as in materiality, form. So we might translate it as mind and body, as a name and form, so that it can be a bit peculiar, because in English the word name doesn't immediately come across as a synonym for mind. The word name doesn't mean mind in English, but in Pali it does, so that there is that connection. We're talking about nama rupa, mentality and materiality. There is no one correct version of what nama rupa means, and often the most accurate interpretation involves the broad spread of meanings. Therefore, one will find numerous translations that use mind and body, materiality, mentality, name and form. All are correct in their own way. Usefully, and especially in the context of the discussion on the teaching to Bahia in chapter 3 earlier on, in Professor Rhys David's translation of the Digha Nikaya, he was also the one who was the founder of the Pali Text Society and helped to write the PTS dictionary. Professor Rhys Davids quotes Neumann's rendering of nama and rupa as subject and object. This is a helpful perspective, since for some, the cessation of consciousness or the destruction of mind and body might seem like depressing or nihilistic phrases, whereas the dissolution of subject-object dualities and the freedom ensuing from that sounds considerably more appealing, to my mind anyway. In this light, it's also worthy of note that the tangible qualities of the mind, where, quote, no footing can be found for everyday dualisms, include radiance and limitlessness, which are hardly uninviting qualities either. So it's kind of acknowledging when you get a translation like cessation of consciousness or the destruction of mind and body, like, well, that sounds pretty awful. But if nama and rupa can also mean mentality, materiality as substantial qualities, or even referring to subject and object, nama as in the subject, rupa as in the object, then that dissolution of subject-object dualities, so rather than the destruction of mind and body, sounding like a kind of death wish or a kind of murderous thought, it's that letting go of subject-object duality or subjectless-objectless awareness, which has got a great spaciousness and brightness and freedom to it. Does that make sense? People able to follow that? Do speak up if it's too mysterious. Okay. The second point is the use of the word nirodha. In the above-quoted sutta, the verb variously translated as destroyed, quote-unquote, cut off, quote-unquote, and held in check is uparujjati, which is virtually identical in meaning to nirujjati, the verb derived from nirodha. Customarily, nirodha is translated as cessation, as in dukkha nirodha, the cessation of suffering. In the above translations, it and its derivations have been variously rendered destroyed, come to cease, but also held in check. The Pali root of the word is rud, R-U-D, of rujjati, which not only implies to end, to stop, or to quench, but also to hold in check, as an impulsive and restless horse is reined in. anyone who's ridden a horse, if you want to stop the horse kind of running away, you keep the reins quite tight, keeping a check on the reins to keep the horse's head tucked in so the horse won't run away so easily. So that's called holding in check, from the root rigidity. Thus there is a breadth of meaning in these key terms of the last two lines of the verses which end both of those passages at the end of the Kevanda Sutta. This is easy to miss in English. Perhaps the best way of paraphrasing them is to say that when the dualistic discriminative process is checked, then the thingness, quote-unquote, the solid externality of the world, and the meanness, quote-unquote, of the mind, are seen as essentially insubstantial. There is no footing for the apparent independent existence of mental or material objects, or an independent subject. So that absence of a footing for the objects of the world, things that are seen, heard, and tasted and touched, or the internal world of thoughts and memories, ideas, emotions, they're not being given a footing, or the sense of an I, an independent observer and knower, a subject, is also not given a footing either. So just to repeat that interpretation, that way of paraphrasing that principle, when the dualistic discriminative process is checked, so when the mind is not going out and giving validity, substantiality to subject and object, then the thingness, the solid externality of the world, and the meanness of the mind are seen as essentially insubstantial. There's no footing for the apparent independent existence of mental or material objects, or an independent subject. Comments or thoughts on any of that?
Not really. I mean, it's dense stuff.
It is, yes, yes.
So pay attention.
I can relate that to the things that I have an emotional response to. But I think you're saying that it's much broader than that.
Well, it's that quality of awareness that is knowing the field of experience of seeing, hearing, smelling, tasting, touching, thinking, remembering, imagining, and not giving that more substantiality, not making a solid world out there or a solid me who's the experiencer or the knower, the doer. And so it's that emptying out, like in that dialogue with Bahia. In the seen, there is only the seen. In the heard, there is only the heard. The mind isn't creating a substantial world or a substantial... there's no... As the Buddha said, you won't find yourself in the world of that or the world of this, in the subject or the object. So it's, in a way, loosening the view, broadening the view, and letting go of those habits of giving a solidity to the field of seeing, hearing, smelling, tasting, touching, thinking, which the mind usually does. The floor is here. I can feel it with my foot. I hear the sound of my voice. I'm sitting here. I'm looking at you. I am here. You are there. Which, on a worldly level, is absolutely inarguable. But at this moment, there is feeling consciousness, seeing consciousness, hearing consciousness, thinking consciousness, arising and passing away. Where is it all happening? In the mind. I close my eyes, you disappear. Open my eyes, you're there again. So we don't experience the world. We experience our mind's representation of the world, moment by moment. Like my TIA a month or so ago is a really good example. There was a breakdown between the sanya, the sense contact, and the sanya vitaka. It's like the eye could see the black marks on the white paper, and that was distinctive, but there was no word. Interestingly, it was the word conundrum I was looking at, ironically. But there was no word there. At that time, there wasn't a word. It was just black marks on a white background. And there was no sound or meaning associated with those marks. So when we say, oh, there are words in this book, are there? Only because of the mind that picks it up and reads it. These are not intrinsically words. They're words insofar as the human mind that's conditioned to recognize these shapes and call them words. But from their own side, they're just configurations of Rupa Khanda. That's it. So the mind that is able to recognize that what we call the world, or what we call ourselves, is a sort of continually emergent set of processes that seem to be a me here looking at a world out there, moment by moment. This is the core of Vipassana meditation. There's a training of the heart to abide and embody that quality of knowing that is changing the view, that it's just hearing, seeing, feeling, smelling, tasting, touching, arising, passing away. The field of experience is a flow of changing perceptions that have no core, no essence. And there isn't an independent I who is the knower, the experiencer, or the doer. The process of insight meditation is that sort of steady deconditioning of the habits of perception and of thinking and attitude, so that the mind is able to know things with greater clarity. So this not giving a landing place is kind of describing that quality of really sort of very clear insight. It's recognizing here and there, long and short, coarse and fine, inside, outside. These are all relative judgments. They're convenient fictions that match the way that the material world operates and that the laws of nature operate, but they're not being given any kind of fixed substantiality. That makes sense? I would say that's really what insight meditation is about, is that clarifying the quality of awakened awareness to know without delusion what we fear, what we hate, what we love, what we think we own, what we think we are. It's rejigging the way the mind holds those. So, for example, one of the phrases I use a lot in meditation is, this which knows a person isn't a person. Or the mind is Dhamma, not a person. Just to reconfigure, to change the kind of framework. This which knows the person isn't a person. I'm not making that as a declaration that everyone should believe, but just a way to contemplate. Awareness is not tall or short, it's not male or female, it has no nationality, no language. But it knows the awake, aware quality of the citta. It knows those personal experiences and perceptions. The name, the age, nationality, or personal stories, but awareness doesn't have a story. And in many of Lumpo Sumedho's recent teachings, he uses that phrase, you know, Dhamma has no language, or awareness has no language. And those are words, he's saying, like, it's a Dhamma teaching, saying, so, you know, Dhamma has no language, while he's giving a Dhamma talk. Again, kind of ironic, but if it really is taken to heart, there's an understanding of what that means, that awareness doesn't have a language. It knows those languaging configurations, but awareness itself is not a linguistic process. Anything you'd add to that? Or?
No, not really. I mean, it's just that sense, because the habit is to go to trying to figure it out, trying to conceive of it, trying to make it solid somehow, whether it's an external world or an internal world, and just to learn how to be comfortable with just knowing, which doesn't have a language, doesn't have a locus.
Or a story.
Or a story. What would I be without my stories?
Yes.
Kind of new for me to come across different definition of the mind. Sometimes is Pali's citta.
Well, there's mano is the mind sense, M-A-N-O. When you talk about the six senses, mano is a word that's used for mind. The mind sense is mano. And then citta, C-I-T-T-A, citta is representing the, particularly the knowing faculty. And when they talk about liberation or the mind being liberated, it's the citta that is liberated. Mano is never used in terms of liberation. So like it's the mano is the sixth of the six senses. So seeing, hearing, eye, ear, nose, tongue, body, mind, when it's that six, mano is the sixth one. But then when it's talking about liberation, their hearts were liberated. When they heard that Dhamma teaching, then the hearts of the five. We were reciting the Anatta Lakkhana Sutta this morning. So the denouement of that, the very end of that, then it's the hearts of those five disciples were liberated. Jitta can be translated as mind, but also as heart. Sometimes it depends on people's usage, but heart is a little bit more common as a translation. Heart.
Yeah. I've spoken with many people, maybe, and we often speak of the mind and we associate it with the mental mind, and mm-hmm. we often feel that is in that area of the head. Then when we feel the heart, we often feel that is like kind of this area in the heart chakra. I can see in meditation, we can actually expand our field of awareness, and then it becomes maybe here, and then we expand it to here, and then maybe we can expand it to the whole body or even more. So is there a different approach to it, or degrees, or depending where we are? Like, is it consciousness as well? There was the word consciousness we were chanting this morning for the...
That's the third of the three words that are often used to refer to the mind faculty as vijnana. So mano, jitta and vijnana, and they all have different shades of meaning. And nama, the mental faculties. So there's a lot of overlap and there isn't 100% consistency. But if you find that the English word heart has unhelpful associations, use Greek or Spanish or French or a language of your choice, or just use the Pali, jitta. Because the conditioning of the mind, when I was in the States, I was invited to give a talk or have a dialogue with a Hindu monk. One of the very earliest ashrams in the USA was in Northern California, a place called Alima, established in the 1920s or 30s. And we had an event with the people there, and they asked for a theme for the day, and I said, liberation of the heart. So we were supposed to both be speaking on this theme. And this Hindu monk saw the subject and he thought the biological heart was what he read. I thought, this is a strange subject. Why are the Buddhists talking about them? Is the heartbeat somehow special to them? Because this languaging of it was a whole different set of conditioning because of the scriptures and the teachings that he had had. And so we had a little bit of a heads together. I said, no, that's not what we mean. That's another meaning to the word heart that we would use. So finding your own words is a helpful part of Dhamma practice. As I said, perhaps use your own language or use Pali or whatever languaging helps to evoke or something that has those associations, say with jitta, that quality of the mental world, the non-physical world that is liberatable, that can be liberated. And finding your own language. It's not fixed, you've got to use certain terms. Using and forming your own way of expressing that helps to lead towards that quality of ease and freedom and peacefulness. Does that make sense?
I think so. I will reflect on that. I think sometimes when I consider the mind as the heart, sometimes then I think the emotions are more involved into it.
Yeah, that covers the jitta. It's all of the above. It's both the cognitive faculty, the thought processes, the emotions. And you think of the jitta satipatthana and knowing and being mindful of the jitta that has greed, with hatred, without hatred. It's the expanded mind, the contracted mind. So there is really no base. It's a commentarial gloss trying to pin it down. Where is the jitta?
Yeah, where doesn't really apply.
Where doesn't apply.
So it's very expansive. Can be very...
Well, essentially, three-dimensional space only applies to Rupa Khanda. Physical space doesn't really apply to the world of mind at all. In essence, it's only... You can't say where my mind stops and yours begins, or my mind is here. There might be passing impressions or particular sensations.
Yeah, I was about to say that. Is there not this point of contact between the two, the sensation, between the mind and the body?
Well, it's good to explore and to investigate that. One of those useful reflections I found in the practice is just a phrase like, where doesn't apply? Or to take a different angle, where is the mind? And then by asking that question, there can be that realization, oh, the word where doesn't apply, location doesn't apply. We have a whole chapter on non-locality. Next chapter is the unconditioned and non-locality.
In the first Dhammapada, Manu seems to be used not as a sensescape, but as sort of a leading part of consciousness.
The first verse of Dhammapada?
Mm-hmm. Manu, the mind is chief, the that follows.
It is Manu, yeah.
Manu Maya.
The Buddha is not 100% consistent. Also, as I said, there's quite a lot of overlap. Like, you know, you've got vijnana both being a liberated quality. 99.9% of the time, it means sense consciousness. But in these teachings, it has a very, very different, completely different flavor. That's why, in a way, part of the forest tradition's lack of emphasis on verbal teachings and more emphasis on meditation and wise reflection. Just say, taking that first verse of the Dhammapada, that mind is the forerunner of all things, manomaya and so on, that's to take up that verse and sit on it, you know, contemplate that and say, well, when it says mano, what's it referring to? How do I feel that? What's the felt sense of that description of the Buddha? When it says mano, is it that which is deciding, that which is leading, that which is experiencing? What is that? So you're using the meditation to explore and investigate. Then the words get a much more substantial meaning. It's not just a sound that you're recollecting, but it's mapped on to your own sort of felt sense, your own experience. But it's quite common, the Buddha's fairly flexible, as I said, broad brush use of language, and is not sort of hyper-specific. Which I think in Indian philosophy is a very, very kind of a much sought after. Well, in Western philosophy as well, kind of being sort of hyper detailed exactly what terms refer to and what they mean in an absolute sense. And it seems that the Buddha quite deliberately took a much more informal, broad brush, flexible use of language. Sometimes, you know, he has his dialogues with people who are quite pedantic. Like in an earlier passage where someone says to him, you use these personal pronouns, like you say I or he or she or they, but surely this is going against your teachings on not self. And the Buddha says, I'm just using language according to the common usage in order to communicate without any delusion about a separate independent I. So it's just, he's using the conventions of speech for the sake of convenience and communication. When he says I, he's not making a declaration about a permanent independent Atman, but just from here, this, rather than saying the Tathagata, once in a while, he does say I. It's not kind of rigidly enforced. The Buddha's really inconsistent. This is not reliable. You know, he should say Tathagata all the time if he was being consistent. But it's not the tone, it's not the flavor of the canon.
Did he use vijnana to describe the mind as the sixth sensescape sometimes? I thought he did. I mean, not to try to pin you down.
It's pretty much when it's, you know, chakku, sota, gana, jiva, kaya, mano. When it's the six, it's...
In the chanting.
It's pretty consistently, that's...
Yeah, pretty consistently. Six sense bases.
That's pretty standard.
Six sense bases, it's very good.
So like each of those is a consciousness. So chakku vijnana, sota vijnana, gana vijnana, jiva. So that they're all consciousnesses.
Okay.
When we recite the fire sermon, those are all mentioned in that. So eye consciousness, ear consciousness, nose, tongue, body, mind consciousness.
Just a quick speculation as we're talking about the question about mind being the forerunner of the Dhammapada. Thinking that quality that the Dhammapada describes seems like it has the quality of the beginning of the formations, like Sankara, with its quality of intention.
Yeah.
Which to me seems like a very mano kind of quality as opposed to the broader chitta quality. So that kind of mind, Mano, being the forerunner of stuff that gets produced.
Yes, the deciding mind. When it says, if you think and act with an unwholesome attitude, then sorrow will follow you as surely as the cart follows the feet of the ox. Yeah. If you think or act with a wholesome mind, then happiness will follow like a never-departing shadow. So it's the deciding, directing quality.
Related to intention.
Yeah, chetana.
Something I notice with a lot of the words that we try to, that are used often in the Pali Canon, that we try to understand through the English language, the way they're employed in everyday Indian use, they are much more about flavour than specific meaning. And actually, mano was just thinking that in Gujarati, when you say manthi, it's to do something with intention. So it's not to do it with the mind, but to do it decisively, to do something decisively, to do something intentionally. So it doesn't locate it as a function. It's not a function, it's like a flavour or a feeling. Yet, so if someone's cooking and they're sort of haphazard, someone will say she didn't cook with intention, or she didn't cook with manthinati jamarti, she's not cooking with intention, or with mindfulness, or what was the other word? Decisiveness.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. And then the same with dukkha. Dukkha has such a huge, it's employed in such a wide, it's like an everyday, all day, every day. So you
all day, every day dukkha.
So again, suffering, it is quite heavy, the way that it's, we use it now, but I had a guy on it in an ashram once. They were talking about where to put the plants, and someone said, oh, don't put that next to that, the tree will be dukkhi. The tree won't like it. That feeling that like those two plants, they shouldn't be next to each other, not compatible. And so he used it like that, like that will make the tree sad. So he used dukkhi in so the spectrum is so huge that it's impossible to say that it means that, but you get a sense of it, just develops this flavour over a period of time. Like, you can just feel it, like, oh yeah, that's dukkha, or that's dukkhi, or that's dukkhi. And man is one that's used a lot as well in a lot of different contexts. But the one that's most common is manthi, is to do something with intention or with decisiveness, but not the mind, not muggage. Brain is used more to the word brain is used if you want to specifically talk about someone using the cognitive faculties. They'll talk about the brain, so they'll say your brain spins. One of my cousins would say to me, "That'll muggage bol chakkar mare, your brain spins a lot." So he's talking about I think and proliferate mm-hmm. a lot. So he would put that to the brain, but he wouldn't say wouldn't say that man fare, your mind. That, he wouldn't use the word man there.
And in English, there's also those kind of constellations of meaning. So, like when with it's an emotion, you wouldn't say my brain is broken. You say my heart is broken.
Yeah.
I heard also in Gujarati that the word that's similar to papancha means kind of contorted or knotted. We don't get that from proliferation, but it's like certainly when the mind is lost in papancha, then it's in that kind of contorted, knotted, sort of tangled state. So.
Mm. But it's nice to break man down so it doesn't feel like such a solid thing, because it can feel, mano can feel very solid sometimes. Mm. Yeah, in Gujarati anyway, maybe it's different, because I know that Pali and Sanskrit or Pali and the Indian languages don't always match up, but it's interesting because Ajahn Kulagamma said that maybe that's how it's meant.
Yeah, I think so. It was very interesting having Venerable Ananda Maitreya. He spent his 70th Vasa here in 1986. He had more reins than the whole rest of the male Sangha put together. His Upatak was senior to Lumpur Sumedho. He had extraordinary linguistic skills. He spoke about 13 or 14 languages. He could speak in Pali, and he had several Indian languages. And so it was marvelous listening to, because he was pick up these kind of things and hearing about the word Baka for the name of the Brahma. There was a Venerable Ananda Maitreya pointed that out. And he said, many of the translators, the English translators of the Pali, they miss so many of these nuances. and aspects of also many puns or double meanings obvious to him with several Indian languages and with Pali and Sanskrit, that the translators completely missed the joke or didn't get the extra shades of meaning that are there with that particular use of a word. The Pali canon is filled with humor, but most of the early translators missed it. Bhikkhu Bodhi was a student of his, so he picks up quite a few of those things and spells them out in the notes sometimes. That sort of feeling for the constellation of meanings and tones around particular words, it was marvelous having him around to illuminate those areas. But I see it's getting on for 7:10, so let's call it to a close now.